Sure.
Do mental afflictions have a sequence? Do they come, for example, as in greed, and then that was usually followed by worry, or and then yeah, that's usually followed by something?
Sometimes there is a sequence, but I think it depends on the circumstance how that sequence unfolds. I mean, there are certain things that tend to follow, but I think there's not like a, you know, in every situation it's this, then this, then this always. But there are obviously connections between certain mental afflictions that one can lead to another and so forth. And so sometimes I saw in a text where they're talking about, I think this 6 mental afflictions, or the 10, and they gave an example of how they were connected. But I think it's not the same in every situation. But there is obviously some connection to it. And of course, we can say that they're all coming from the fundamental ignorance, this grasping onto independent me. That's the source of all of them. And then generally from those that comes the two, the attachment to pleasant, the aversion to unpleasant, which then have their own flavours, and then on basis of those, all the others come either individually or combination of those. So there are other mental afflictions then that you could sort of see that there is normally a certain sequence to them. But I think there's not like one standard sequence always.
Maybe this goes too far, but I really try to understand it. Yesterday I was thinking about it. A baby has no conceptual sense of self. A baby doesn't have a me. It has a non-conceptual sense of, okay, I'm hungry, or I am hunger, I am thirst, I am lonely, but it doesn't have this thinking, looking in the mirror, that's me.
It does. I think at the very early stages, my understanding is that very early on, the baby's difficult to differentiate itself from the world. That it can't. It has to learn to differentiate. This is part of me, and this is not.
Yeah.
So even this sort of to be able to draw a line within, because the baby's experiencing, but to draw a line of experiencer versus experienced, the baby finds that difficult. They have to learn how to do that. And of course they do learn to do that. And of course, cognitively, they haven't got an elaborate system of conception in terms of naming and so forth. But at a more basic level, of course, then they do learn to distinguish sort of me from not me. And then they learn to distinguish, you know, food and so forth. Like a dog, like any animal, also has a very sort of fairly basic cognitive ability. But even a dog can understand this is food, this is danger, you know. So they have concepts, but of course not so elaborately developed as our concepts as an adult. So of course it takes the development of the brain to support that more higher level cognitive function. But certainly, even very early on, a baby has a sense of me versus not me and so forth.
I'm not quite sure. I mean, if you go even back further into the womb, where the baby is on the last steps before getting born. I mean, I don't know, and I think it's experimentally not to be proven that there's no sense of me.
Yeah, that's what I said. Even when they're born, studies on it. I think for the first short period, the baby has difficulty distinguishing itself from not self. Like it can't all even forget about the mother, but just anything. It doesn't know where. It can't really distinguish experiencer from experienced. It has to sort of start to learn to do that. And then the question is.
And the question is, though, do we try to get into the state of not being, well, we are trying not to be fixed to this me anymore, at least in the state of meditation, to dissolve it, which would be quite the same kind of state.
No, this is what's called the pre-trans fallacy. I think they use it a lot in like philosophy and that, pre-trans fallacy. And it is, and some people you see say, oh, we need to go back to the state of the baby. Mm-hmm. But this is the pre-trans fallacy, is that the baby is not able to distinguish itself from others, but that's much different than someone who realizes there's no separate me and separate world. That's the trans. The pre is the baby. The trans is someone who comes to realize there's no boundary here. Those experiences are very different. The baby just doesn't have the ability to even draw lines yet. Whereas the older person realizes that they're drawing lines. They realize there's no boundary. So there's a big difference between realizing there's no boundary and it's just line drawing versus not even be able to draw lines. So, but often you see that people say we need to get back to the baby-like experience. No. That's what's called pre-trans fallacy.
It's like the fundamental question. Like if we take Christian point of view, there is body, mind, and soul. In a way, like body is a car, and the mind is navigation system, let's say, system of guidance or whatever. And the soul is the driver, the pilot. But in Buddhism, there is only the car and navigation system. It's like a computer.
No.
Who is taking choices? Who is making choices?
The person.
Who has the free will?
Free will doesn't exist.
It doesn't exist.
Well, it depends how you define it. Normally, people define free will as independent agent.
Mm-hmm. But in the beginning, Christian point of view, it's clear. Okay, car, navigation system, and the driver.
You can also use that in Buddhism. Car, navigation system, driver.
But who is the driver? There is no independent self. There is no independent me.
Right.
There is no separate me from the world. Not separate me from the car. Not separate me from the navigation system. Where is the driver?
Well, then the question is, where is the car? Where is the navigation system?
Yeah.
Where?
Yeah, I see it.
Really? You can find a body there?
It becomes complicated.
It's not complicated. No. Again, whether you want to use the analogy of a driver car navigation system, mm-hmm. in Buddhism they all have the same level of existence. None of them are findable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because in Christianity it's clear. You know, it's
and in Buddhism it's clear.
Also clear. Mm-hmm.
Can you find a star there? From its own side, independent of your conceptual framework?
No.
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 Can you find a body here independent of your conceptual framework?
No.
No. Can you find a mind here independent of your conceptual framework?
Yeah.
No. Can you find a person here independent of your conceptual framework? No. Does body, star, mind, person exist? Yes. That's it. See, the problem is, for us, for something to exist, it must be findable. Therefore, yes, there seems to be a body here, there seems to be a mind here, so if there's a person, we must be able to find it. Where is the person that's here? So therefore, most traditions, or many traditions, posit the person as something else. Because there's a body, there's a mind, so you can seem to point and find them. Mm-hmm. Then if there's a person, it must be something, a third thing.
Yeah.
And so then we talk about soul, Atman, spirit, whatever you want to name it. But Buddhism says this is just a intellectual creation. It's not based in experience. You cannot find this supposed extra thing here. If you really look empirically, is there anything here more than the body and the mind? And the Buddhist assertion is if we look empirically, you won't find that. But that doesn't mean there's no person. Because, again, things exist and they're not findable. That's why they can exist, because they're not findable.
So you said there is no free will, no freedom?
Well, it depends how you define free will.
Huh?
It depends how you define the word free will.
So if there is a person,
yeah,
then he's supposed to have the free will.
Why?
The freedom of choice.
Freedom of choice and free will, the same thing.
Yeah, if I have free will, I have freedom to choose.
If you define free will as just simply our freedom or ability to choose,
yeah,
I don't think that's how normally people define free will.
Yeah.
Often they define free will as that we can independently do whatever we want, independently. But in Buddhism, nothing exists independently. So if that's our idea of free will, it's absurd. It's illogical.
Mm-hmm.
Because nothing exists independently. So you can't say free will means an independent agent can do whatever he wants. That doesn't exist. But if we can say free will means our ability to choose,
mm-hmm,
which normally that's not how people define free will, but if we talk about it as our ability to choose, yes, of course we have free will. Do we normally exercise free will? No, because we are stimulus reaction machines. We get a stimulus, we don't choose, we react based on habit. In that sense, there's no free will. So if we want to have free will in terms of ability to choose, we need mindfulness. Without mindfulness, we can't choose. We just react based on habit. But if we have mindfulness, then we can choose to respond in a different way. In that sense, we can talk about free will, but not in the sense that there's an independent me here can do whatever it wants. That idea is nonsensical.
For me, it's a little bit tricky. Like you said, you must develop loving kindness and compassion. Who is supposed to do it?
The person.
Develop the person.
Yeah.
He doesn't exist.
Of course he does.
Independently.
No.
And he is just a machine who is reacting.
A machine? No. Person's not a machine. Person's not a machine.
A little bit contradictory for me.
Again, the reason it seems to be contradictory,
mm-hmm,
is we believe in duality. And as long as we grasp onto duality, of course this will seem contradictory. Of course. But Buddhism would say, check your assumption. Is there duality or not? Look, and if we come to see there's no duality, then this makes perfect sense. But as long as we're grasping onto duality, me, world, of course this won't make sense.
And it looks a little bit also unclear why some people choose to come to meditate, for instance, to choose this kind of, let's say, development or evolution or whatever, and most are not even interested about it.
It's our like conditioning.
Everybody is combination of parts, but why this
conditioning?
Special parts
causes and conditions.
Yeah.
Causes and conditions.
Again.
That's it. There's no higher power up there.
So it's not like my choice. It's not my merit.
But that
it's
choice.
My guilt that I'm not.
The choice that, again, there's two things going on.
Mm-hmm.
In the present moment, there is a result, there's an experience. And that comes from causes and conditions.
Mm-hmm.
We can't choose what's happening in the present moment.
Mm-hmm.
It comes from causes and conditions. What we can choose, if we have mindfulness, is how to respond to that. If we have no mindfulness, we really don't have any choice. We just react out of habit. And then we have no free will. But if we have mindfulness, then we can choose to respond in a different way and create different habits and see a different future. But it's all, of course, within cause and effect. To think that there's an independent agent floating independently of all that is absurd. It's absurd.
But is it possible to say, for instance, like, if I'm not still the Buddha, I'm not enlightened, that's it's not my fault. It's like the combination of the
not my fault.
Because sometimes I have this feeling of guilt. How many years?
Well, the guilt is cognitive fusion. So what we need to be careful of, and then we'll move on to the topic, is we do one of two things. We either do cognitive fusion, and usually with the negative, and that's why we have guilt, low self-esteem, and self-hatred. Or the other thing we do is we separate. Oh, I didn't do that. Wasn't me. So we cut from the behavior. Either we identify or we cut. Both, of course, are pathological and extreme. You know, either identify with my bad behavior, bad me, and have guilt and low self-esteem and self-hatred, or we don't want to acknowledge it. We go, I didn't do it. Wasn't me. And that's, of course, also pathological. So anyway, let's go on to the topic. So this morning we were looking, so we're in the third point, of course, how to take adverse conditions into the path. And we looked this morning about how to take adverse conditions into the path using conventional bodhicitta. Conventional bodhicitta, of course, is exchanging self with others. And so we saw here, to be able to take adverse conditions into the path, we have to correctly identify who's the enemy, who's the friend. Now we tend to feel as if this self-cherishing mind is our friend bringing us happiness, and we tend to see those people out there as the enemy. They're the ones who cause me suffering. And of course, as long as we see this, we're not going to be able to take adverse conditions into the path at all. We need to have a correct understanding that the real enemy is our self-cherishing mind, bringing us only suffering, and the real friends are the people out there. Whether or not they act in a kind or harmful way to us, they are the friend, and we should cherish them. And so if we have that attitude of eliminating self-cherishing, cherishing others, then, of course, we're going to be able to take adverse conditions into the path. Because if that person is trying to harm us, we can use that to develop compassion, to develop patience, and to improve our qualities and to actually help that person. Now, and this part here is not so easy to appreciate, is how we can take adverse conditions into the path using ultimate bodhicitta, the wisdom of emptiness. And here we'll go through what it says, and then we'll try to explain it, but I think you may find it a little bit difficult to follow, but let's see what we can do. And here, halfway down on page 11 on the left, it says, taking adverse conditions onto the path by means of training in the ultimate awakening mind. Following this, the second, taking adverse conditions onto the path of enlightenment by means of training the ultimate waking mind, is presented in the following. With the three views and treasury of space, the protection of yoga is unexcelled. By meditating on illusions as the four Buddha bodies, emptiness is protection unsurpassed. Okay, let's see if we can understand a little bit what that means. We'll read the commentary and then we'll comment a little bit more. Conclude decisively that everything in this world of appearance, both the external environment and the beings within, such as the object of impairment and the agent of impairment, are only deluded perceptions of your own mind. As mere deceptive, deluded appearances, both polarities will cease within moments, with no time either to injure or to engage in any negation or affirmation. So what this is saying is that if we are receiving harm from an agent of harm, a person, and we understand that this person, the agent of harm and ourself, of course, are mere appearances, that they do not exist independently, we do not exist independently, then this sort of subject-object duality will drop away, which means that we won't be able to develop any mental afflictions with respect to this situation because we have let go of self-grasping, grasping onto independent me, independent other person. And therefore, it'll become impossible to react to that situation with anger and so forth. So it says here, so even conventionally, nothing exists as an object or agent of harm. So, of course, this means nothing exists from its own side as an object or agent of harm. On the ultimate level, no phenomena is primordially established. Again, nothing exists inherently independently. Like the center of a spotless sky, phenomena are all one. So here again, this is a little bit awkward. I don't know, I don't have the Tibetan for this, but I don't think the Tibetan is literally saying this. What we could say here is that phenomena are all one nature. That makes sense, but they're all one is very awkward. So, again, I'd have to see what the Tibetan was saying to make a different translation, but to say that they're all one would be technically incorrect. Since self is an awareness devoid of substantial reality and the agent of harm is an awareness devoid of substantial reality as well, meaning there's no independent me, there's no independent agent of harm. Neither exists as object of impairment or agent of impairment. Everything is empty and emptiness cannot be attacked by emptiness, just as the eastern part of the sky cannot cause harm to the western part. They, the object of impairment and the agent of impairment, cannot injure each other. Therefore, since your current perceptions are illusions of a deluded mind, the self, the object of impairment, and the illnesses, other than being constructs of your mind, nothing can be established in terms of identity, meaning nothing exists through its own unique nature. Nothing exists independently. And here's a quote that says, your own mind is Mara. Mara is sort of another word for demon. Your own mind is the obstructive force. All obstructive forces arise from conceptualization. Therefore, relinquish conceptualization. Because you have grasped your concepts as real, as true, as something separate from your mind, and as fault-ridden, this has produced all the sufferings of cyclic existence. So again, here, by not understanding that things are merely existing within our conceptual framework, their mere appearance is merely labelled, by seeing them as something, as a separate from the mind, meaning independent of the mind, this has produced all the sufferings of cyclic existence. And we saw that earlier, how this grasping onto independent me, independent world, leads to attachment, aversion, and the whole mess of samsara. Apart from your own conceptualization, nothing outside is an obstructor. Therefore, your own conceptualization is the sole object of elimination. When examined in this manner, everything comes down to your mind, and the mind too, when examined, is found to be emptiness, that we cannot find the mind. Of course, that does not mean the mind doesn't exist. It just means it's empty of findable inherent existence. There is no difference between the clear light nature of your own mind, the clear light nature of the minds of all sentient beings, and the pristine cognition of the Buddha's enlightened mind. They are equally Dharmakaya, the Buddha body of reality. So here now, we're going to shortly on the next page see how what this root verse means. It says, by meditating on illusions, meaning the things that we see, as the four Buddha bodies, emptiness is protection unsurpassed. Meaning that when we see here, of course, adverse conditions, but in general in daily life, when we see these conditions, to see them as like an illusion, to see them in terms of the four Buddha bodies, that's protection unsurpassed, meaning that will protect us from suffering. So therefore, what I'd like to briefly do now, and it comes over on the next page, is what are these four Buddha bodies? And what's been translated here as body is kaya. And when we see the word body, we shouldn't think this, because this is not the meaning of the word kaya. Maybe four aspects is another way of translating. But again, usually the four kayas is translated as body. So the four kayas, or four aspects of an enlightened being, of course, is just like a normal person, an enlightened being has a body and a mind. So if we divide the enlightened being into two, we can talk about the two kayas. The Dharmakaya, which is the enlightened mind. And here often Dharmakaya is translated as something like truth body. So that's the enlightened mind. And then, of course, the physical manifestation of enlightened being is called Rupakaya. Which often is translated as form body. But then the Rupakaya can be divided into two. Or there can be two types of form bodies. There is what's called the Sambhogakaya, which often is translated as something like complete enjoyment body. And that is a subtle form of manifestation of an enlightened being. So enlightened being can manifest in many ways. One way is as a Sambhogakaya. It's a very subtle type of manifestation that a normal person cannot perceive. So Sambhogakaya can only be perceived by practitioners very high on the path. Particularly, in particular, Arya Bodhisattva. So we have to really be an Arya Bodhisattva to be able to see and perceive a Sambhogakaya, this very subtle way of manifestation of an enlightened being. And then we have what's called Nirmanakaya, and that's often translated as emanation body. So that is a physical manifestation of enlightened being that is perceivable by an average person, ordinary practitioner. So these are sort of two levels of manifestation. So then sometimes, so again, the brief presentation is there's two kayas, the Dharmakaya, Rupakaya. And then sometimes there's three kayas, and usually when there's three kayas presented, we talk about Dharmakaya, and then the Rupakaya divided into two, so we talk about Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, Nirmanakaya. So that's often when we talk about three kayas of a Buddha. But here we talk about four kayas, and four kayas, the other one here is called the Svabhavikakaya. And this can be, sometimes it's done as the Dharmakaya divided into two. So sometimes this is called Svabhavakaya or Svabhavikakaya. And this is usually translated as something like nature, truth, body. And as the name suggests, the nature truth body is the nature of the truth body, of the Dharmakaya. So the nature, of course, of the Dharmakaya, like everything that exists, is emptiness. So Svabhavikakaya is the emptiness nature of the Dharmakaya. But also, of course, it can be the empty nature of the Sambhogakaya and the Manakaya, because they're also, of course, empty of independent existence. So Svabhavikakaya, the nature body, can be the nature of all three kayas. And it is, in fact. And then when it's split into two, sometimes then the Dharmakaya here is called the Jhana Dharmakaya. Which is translated often as wisdom truth body. So that's the four kayas. We have the Svabhavakaya or Svabhavikakaya, the nature body or nature truth body, which is the nature of the other three bodies. The Dharmakaya, the mind of the enlightened being. Sambhogakaya, a very subtle manifestation of enlightened being that only Arya Bodhisattvas can perceive. And the Nimanakaya is the normal manifestation of enlightened being that can be seen by ordinary beings. Emanation body, it's called. So these are the two, three, or four kayas, and they come up in the text very shortly. Any question about that? Anything not clear about the presentation?
We don't know even what to ask.
So again, this is just the aspects of an enlightened being. The enlightened mind is the Dharmakaya. The physical form of the enlightened being is the Rupakaya. And that enlightened being can appear in at least two levels. A very subtle level called Sambhogakaya that only Arya Bodhisattvas can perceive. And an Nimanakaya is the normal aspect of enlightened being that we can perceive. And then, of course, all of these three aspects, the mind and the physical aspect of the enlightened being, all are, of course, empty of independent existence. They all lack inherent existence. And that's the Svabhavakaya, Svabhavikakaya, is the nature body. That these all three are empty of inherent existence.
Are they at different levels of becoming a Buddha? Or?
No, this is enlightened being already.
And they're not different levels of enlightened beings. They're all...
No.
This is one being that has all of these.
Yes, one enlightened being can appear in multiple forms simultaneously. So in theory, there could be one enlightened being appearing as everyone else in this room here, pretending to be students to help me. Caught you out, didn't I? See, I'm smart. I'm smart.
When we talk about this Nirmanakaya, we could say that Siddhartha.
Right.
We talk about
So, one point here is we talk, of course, historically, Prince Siddhartha achieved enlightenment, became Buddha, Shakyamuni, and so forth. In the different traditions, they look at that a little bit differently. Generally, in the Theravada traditions, Prince Siddhartha was sort of just a normal person, put a lot of effort in and achieved enlightenment. Generally in the Mahayana, but certainly in the Tibetan Mahayana tradition, it's generally accepted that Prince Siddhartha was already enlightened. Prince Siddhartha was a Nimanakaya, appearing to be in a normal form to show, to display to others how to achieve enlightenment. So that he was already enlightened, even as Prince Siddhartha. So generally in Tibetan tradition, Prince Siddhartha was already a Nimanakaya, a physical manifestation of someone who had achieved enlightenment much earlier. So that's generally the Tibetan interpretation. Whereas in Theravada, they wouldn't generally agree with that. Because also in Theravada, of course, these things don't exist. That once someone like Prince Siddhartha achieved enlightenment, became Shakyamuni Buddha, then they may call Shakyamuni Buddha Nimanakaya, they may use that, but certainly when that Shakyamuni Buddha passed into Parinirvana, finished, end of story. No more Shakyamuni Buddha. So for the Theravada, the person who was Shakyamuni Buddha is definitely not appearing anywhere in the world today. Finish their story. Whereas Mahayana would say that's a little bit illogical to think like that. So, but this is a Theravada assertion.
Dharmakaya, nature, truth, body, and wisdom, truth, body. Again, are we talking about subtle? I mean, what are we really talking about? What kind of body? Because...
Well, it's not a body again, so forget this idea of body. Okay, it's aspect. Okay. It's aspect. It's not a body. It's not this. This is the mind, not a body.
Okay.
It's the Dharmakaya, the... Again, that's why the word body can be misleading. It's not they've got four different things like this. Kaya means more like aspect.
Okay.
Aspects. Four aspects to the enlightened being. The mind, two types, levels of body, and the emptiness of that, of those bodies. That's the four kayas.
But you're saying Sarvakaya only
Only Arya Bodhisattvas can see these because their mind is purified enough to be able to... Because this is a very subtle manifestation that we can't see as an ordinary person, as Sambhogakaya, only Arya Bodhisattvas.
So what exactly is... I mean, my question is, could it be like someone that we will see like as an ordinary person, but Arya...
We will not see that at all.
So...
It's not physical,
yes,
like this. It's not made of atoms.
So it exists as what?
Energy, if you want to use a word.
In the world, you mean?
That a Sambhogakaya always appears in a pure form. Like the normal form that you see enlightened beings.
Yeah.
That's the sort of archetypal form. Sambhogakaya always appears in this manner.
And, okay, so like what are they...
Teach Arya Bodhisattvas.
Ah, okay.
They're teaching Arya Bodhisattvas, helping them to complete the path.
So, as we all have Buddhahood, and finally we will realize this Buddhahood and become Buddhas ourselves, so we have also those four bodies already innate in our own.
Ah, yes. So, this is what we see here, And here we have, this is the idea of Buddha nature, is we can have at least two perspectives here. And I like to use the analogy of the window to help understand. You know, we've got a window and it's got some dirt on it. So we can have at least two perspectives of that. We can say, there's a dirty window. I need to make effort to produce a clean window. And that's normally the perspective we adopt. It's valid.
Yeah.
Equally, we could say, actually, there's already a clean window there. We just need to remove the dirt to reveal the clean window that was always already there. Mm. True? The result is the same. We have to remove the dirt. But the perspective is very different. So therefore... Dharmakaya, or Buddha nature, can be a potential, you know. With that window, because the dirt is not part of the nature of the window, that window has a potential to become a clean window, because the dirt's not in the nature of the window. That's one way of looking at Buddha nature. That's how Buddha nature is normally described in the Geluk school. It's a potential. Just like the dirt is not part of the window, therefore that window has a potential to become a clean window. Just because our mental afflictions are not part of the nature of our mind, therefore our mind has the potential to become Dharmakaya. Mm-hmm. So that's
okay, first.
Yeah. Second one is, there's already a clean window there. We're not producing something new. All we're doing is removing the dirt to reveal what was always there. Correct? So the second one is the Dharmakaya is already within us. All you have to do is remove the mental afflictions to reveal the Dharmakaya that's already there. And that's, so Buddha nature in Nikagyu Nyingma is not a potential. It's the enlightened mind is already within us. There's already a Buddha within us. The Dharmakaya is already here. And this is a little bit how I think it's used here, because Chikawa, he was coming really from the Nyingma tradition, or he had Nyingma teachers. So here in the explanation, we tend to have more of that perspective. Now, both of these perspectives are valid, but both of them have advantages and disadvantages. Because if we adopt the perspective, the Buddha nature is a potential, only a potential, then we could go, oh, so much work to do. I have to do so much work to produce a clean window. It's just too much work. It's impossible. Yeah? That's the disadvantage of that one. The other one, that the Dharmakaya is already here. There's already a clean window there. Already clean. I don't need to do anything. It's already clean. I'm already enlightened. I don't need to do anything.
But you still have to remove the dirt and both perspectives.
Correct, but the danger is you go to those extremes. The first extreme, the first one is, oh, that's just too much work. I'm not even going to bother. And the danger in the second one is, I'm already enlightened. I don't need to do anything. I'm already a Buddha. I'm okay.
Is there a middle path for those?
So both are effective if we follow them correctly. But it's easy for each of those to slide to those extremes. So therefore, I think for us as an individual, we can adopt the perspective that works best for us, or even adopt a sort of a combination of the two. And so this is a little bit what we see here, is what they're talking about. Particularly the second perspective, I think, is more prevalent in this sort of explanation in the commentary here. So let's have a look at that. Let's see if we can understand what this verse is saying. Okay, so we finished off with the Dharmakaya. So who can be harmed? Who causes the harm? And how is anyone harmed? Ultimately, nothing exists as a separate reality. Conventionally, however, all illnesses and malevolent forces exist as your own concepts, reflecting that the concepts too exist as Dharmakaya. Place the mind naturally at rest, free of any conceptualization. Is another sort of Tibetan expression, like throwing up vomit. Place your mind free of all clinging. Let the corpse of a leper... Like the corpse of a leper, discard as if it were of no use. Like a dead person's empty house, release it without clinging. So here, we see a little bit this flavor of the second one, is that our Dharmakaya is obscured by the mental afflictions in this conceptual mind. So just release all of that, and then allow that Dharmakaya to become manifest. And this is what it's saying here a little bit. And then it says, reflect. Although phenomena are not established primordially, yet I remain bound as though unable to undo knots made in the sky or strangled by a tortoise hair noose. So these are sometimes analogies used to talk about self. That, you know, of course, you can't make a knot in the sky. And the hair of a tortoise doesn't exist. But these are often analogies to exemplify the self, because the self doesn't exist. It says, as such, my mind has arisen as a demon and chained by conceptualization. I remain bewildered in suffering. So we are grasping onto the me as existing independently. So we're grasping onto this self, which of course does not exist. The self is like the hair of a tortoise. It's like a knot in the sky, complete non-existent. But that because of believing in that and grasping onto it as if it existed, now it has turned into a demon. And that's where, of course, all the suffering's coming from. So it says, all hopes and fears, such as fearing illness or harm from ghosts or hoping to be cured of illnesses, as well as all thoughts of negation and affirmation in emptiness, place them all within the sphere of emptiness and release them within ultimate reality itself. Meaning that to let go of grasping onto all of these things, hopes and fears and so forth, a negation and affirmation really means attachment, aversion. Let go of grasping all to those and release them into this sphere of emptiness. And so rest in that experience then of Dharmakaya. And then it says here, and this is something we talked about briefly earlier, imagine that unable to bear this, you react violently, pulling at the hem of your clothes and shouting your name aloud. So remember, again, this is very common experience in the beginning stage of doing this practice, is that when we do this emptiness practice and we release all grasping, particularly grasping onto this body as me and the mind as me, if we release all that grasping, then there's nothing reinforcing a sense of me. And then often we have a lot of fear. And so it's very common in the emptiness practice as a beginning point to have fear coming up. And there's a very classic case of, I think, one of the great masters, when they introduced this emptiness practice to one of their students, the student actually grabbed the hem of their shirt or something just to make sure, I'm really here, you know, I'm not existent. So that's what it's talking about here. So it says, if when you do this releasing of grasping and releasing into emptiness, you react violently, thinking that you're going out of existence, it says, you tremble, the hairs of your body stand on end, and you experience the dissolution of the 10 classes of consciousness. I'm not sure exactly what these 10 classes of consciousness mean, but again, basically the dissolution of a solid body and dissolution of a mind. It says, at that instant, though there are two streams of awareness, of course the two streams of awareness is the awareness that is observing and the awareness that is being observed, think that they are both your own mind, they are but different modes of perception. As you contemplate thus, your thoughts and awareness will calm, and your body and mind will rest in their own natural states. When the thought arises spontaneously, oh, everything is my mind, non-conceptuality dawns in its nakedness. So this is what it's starting to say here, is that what we're going to do in this emptiness practice is the very appearances, particularly of the agents of harm and so forth, are going to help us to realize emptiness. Because now appearances seem to block emptiness, because appearances seem to confirm to us that things actually exist independently. But through our understanding of emptiness and our experience of emptiness in meditation, then in daily life, and this is what's coming up in the next section here, is instead of appearances blocking emptiness and seeming to oppose emptiness, due to our understanding of emptiness and familiarity with that in meditation, then the very appearances that appear to us can reaffirm to us that things are empty, that this is a mere appearance. And thereby, that mere appearance can help us to rest in that experience of emptiness, that everything's just like an illusion. And we do that relating it to these four kayas. So let's have a look now at how we do that, or how that happens in relationship to these four kayas. It says, therefore, when sickness, malevolent forces, and your own self are examined with the pristine cognition of discriminative awareness, so this is this illusory-like emptiness practice that we investigate these appearances in daily life, whether it's sickness, some sort of agent of harm, or whether it's ourself, when we investigate that with this discriminative awareness, none are found to have ever come into being. Meaning, none are found to ever be inherently produced. This is the unborn Dharmakaya. So the Dharmakaya is unborn in the sense that the Dharmakaya is always there. It's primordially present. So it's unborn in a sense that it's not like it's not there and then now we're going to create one. We're going to, the Dharmakaya is going to come into existence at some point. It's unborn, meaning it's already there. And so just like the Dharmakaya is unborn, meaning it's always there, then here we can... The parallel to that is that when we look at appearances, we can see that none of these appearances, that all of these appearances are unborn in the sense that they're not inherently produced. So that's the parallel, is that between the Dharmakaya and appearances. And then if we look at the next one, it says, the unborn has no cessation. So if things are not inherently produced, they do not inherently cease. And that fact is correlated with the Sambhogakaya. It says here, and this absence of cessation is the unceasing enjoyment Buddha body. And the reason that things are not inherently ceasing is correlated with this, is that the Sambhogakaya, it said, is... always present till the end of time teaching Dharma, that it's unceasing, it continues to teach forever. So that's the parallel here. And then it says, between origination and cessation there is no abiding. So if things are not inherently produced, they do not inherently cease, then of course they do not inherently abide. And the absence of abiding is the non-abiding emanation Buddha body. So here, emanation body is the parallel, is non-abiding. Is that an enlightened being is not abiding in samsara or nirvana. Because nirvana is solitary peace. So the whole purpose of coming enlightened is to manifest, to emanate again and again, to help others. So that state of emanating, of course, the emanation is not abiding in samsara and not abiding in nirvana. Nirvana is solitary peace. So that's what the non-abiding is referring to, the Nirmanakaya. So that's the sort of parallel here. And then the fourth one, it says, that which does not exist in any of the three times, i.e. past, present or future, is devoid of substantial reality. And this absence of substantial reality is the natural Buddha body. So that's the Svabhavakaya. So Svabhavakaya, of course, is the emptiness of these three bodies. No nature. So therefore, that's... parallel with the fact that things do not exist past, present or future. So this is how this experience of emptiness is correlated to the four Buddha bodies. I'd just like to briefly read from Alan Wallace regarding this to see if we can get any more clarity.
Possible to ask a question?
Sure.
You mentioned two types of awareness. How is this possible?
What do you mean?
Well, you said there are two kinds of awareness.
You know, we can have many kinds of awareness. We can be aware of the bowl, aware of ourself. We can be aware of many things.
But awareness is one. It's like,
yeah, I didn't say two awarenesses. I said two types of awareness. We can have many types of mind, but there's only one mind. So here, when he was talking about two types of awareness, we're talking about the awareness that is being observed and the awareness that is observing that. But of course, they're not two awarenesses. It's not having one awareness here, observing another awareness there. They're two aspects of the one awareness, of course.
When Tibetans say rikpa, they mean what? Awareness which is aware of itself, or what?
Rikpa?
Yeah.
It depends the context. I mean, rikpa is simply awareness, but generally in the Nyingma school of Tibetan Buddhism, when they use the word rikpa, they don't just mean awareness in general. They only really use the word rikpa to refer to the very subtle clear light mind, to the Dharmakaya, for them. In other schools, it doesn't have that connection. Rikpa can just mean knowing, to be aware. Because, in fact, the definition of mind in Tibetan is sel shing rikpa, clear and knowing. So there the word rikpa just means knowing.
And what is the pristine cognition of discriminative awareness? What's that?
Yeah. Discriminative awareness is, again, our ability to investigate. And often pristine cognition here, it depends on the context, but sometimes this can refer to the very subtle mind as well. Sometimes that very subtle mind is called sort of like primordial mind, sometimes called pristine cognition. So again, here I think this is indicating this idea of the Dharmakaya within. Again, Chikawa, what his main teachers, I think, were coming from the Nyingma tradition. So let's briefly read what Alan Wallace says here about this verse that we're looking at. He said, meditating on delusive appearances as the four embodiments, or the four kayas, entails engaging with all circumstances to cultivate wisdom. So again, to use the very appearances that we receive to deepen our understanding of emptiness, as opposed now of grasping onto them and going the opposite direction. Delusive appearances include all appearances of the environment, sentient beings, of our own body and mind. Mahayana Buddhism identifies the central element of spiritual practice to be the development of bodhicitta, and a person in whom this motivation arises effortlessly is called a bodhisattva. There is a caveat, an important and subtle one, concerning the happiness of a bodhisattva. Recall that a bodhisattva emphasizes with the sufferings of others but doesn't become overwhelmed by it. Instead, the suffering of others acts as a catalyst for genuine compassion. When all of life is brought into Dharma practice, this includes unhappy circumstances, and it is exactly these unhappy circumstances that serve as platforms from which to cultivate the six perfections of generosity, ethics, patience, joyous effort, concentration, and wisdom that provide the structure of the bodhisattva way of life. The bodhisattva embraces adversity with the aim of attaining enlightenment by transmuting everything, felicity and adversity, into spiritual practice. In the bodhisattva way of life, it is the cultivation of relative bodhicitta that serves as protection from mental suffering. That's what we talked about, this mental suffering, self-cherishing and attachment, aversion, and so forth. By empowering spiritual practice with the momentum to move beyond empathy to genuine compassion. Relative bodhicitta provides protection from mental suffering, but there can still be physical suffering. The best protection against physical suffering, Atisha tells us, is the realization of emptiness, ultimate bodhicitta. The challenge here is to ascertain that all phenomena, including those that inflict harm, are solely delusive appearances to our own minds. Ultimately, no phenomenon has its own inherent existence. All are like apparitions emerging from space. The ascertainment of emptiness counteracts the reification or the grasping of subject and object, even for those objects that inflict harm. By realizing the lack of inherent existence of both that which inflicts suffering and the I who suffers, phenomena appear to arise out of space and dissolve back into space. If meditative quiescence or shamatha is weak, the mind is not stable enough for the realization of emptiness to have a deep and lasting impact. There are many examples of Hindu and Buddhist yogis who were able to withdraw their attention by the power of meditative concentration from what would otherwise be great physical pain. The ability to withdraw and stabilize attention at will through the practice of shamatha is a very valuable skill. But insight, or vipassana, goes deeper. With the realization of emptiness, there is no need to withdraw awareness from pain. The pain is experienced, but with insight into emptiness, you are not captured by it. The aphorism of the mind training refers to delusive appearances as the four embodiments, or the four kayas. In his commentaries to this training, Dilgo Khyentse was a great modern day master in the Nyingma school, and he wrote a commentary on this mind training. So he's quoting here Dilgo Khyentse. He says, Dilgo Khyentse explains that the first embodiment, the Dharmakaya, or embodiment of reality, is the absence of inherent existence of everything, all objects and subjects, including our own mental afflictions. None of these phenomena truly come into existence by their own nature, so they are in reality unborn. That which is unborn never ceases, and the unceasing nature of pure awareness is the Sambhogakaya, or embodiment of perfect enjoyment, while the mind and all objects apprehended by the mind are by nature empty. This emptiness is not merely a kind of vacuity like empty space. Rather, all experienced phenomena arise like reflected images in the mind. And that reflection-like nature is called the Nimanakaya, or embodiment of emanations. The inseparability of the unborn, unceasing, and all-manifesting nature of awareness is called the Svabhavakaya, or natural embodiment. By viewing all phenomena, especially our mental afflictions, as delusive appearances of these four embodiments, we shall see that in reality there is nothing to purify, nothing to reject. All is seen as perfect displays of pure awareness, which by nature is empty, luminous, and infinitely creative. And so again here, Dilgo Khyentse is coming from the Nyingma school, which is similar to what I talked about earlier in the Mahamudra, when I said that all appearances are mind, mind is empty, empty is spontaneous presence is naturally or self-liberating. Same here. If we can see all appearances as arising out of emptiness, then that spontaneous presence, all those appearances, even if it's someone trying to harm us, a mental affliction, ourself, they will be self-liberating, meaning we'll not grasp onto them and they won't create any mental afflictions or suffering. Easy, no?
Very easy.
No? Come on. That's just so easy to do. See?
Maybe the third time I come.
So again, if we want to begin to do this, we need two things. We need mindfulness. I mean, if we want to do this sort of practice in daily life, we need really to have some taste or experience of emptiness in meditation to support that, not just intellectual. And to have a taste of emptiness in meditation, we need the shamatha, we need mindfulness. So then if we have some little taste of emptiness in meditation, then this actually is not that difficult to begin to do, because we'll base it on experience. And then with mindfulness in daily life, based on our meditative experiences, then if we use this discriminative awareness, we really can start to see everything that appears, including our own body and mind, anyone there, even if someone's trying to harm us, we will really start to see that this is arising out of emptiness. These are mere appearances. They're not existing from their own side. And if we can really start to see things like this, you'll find that, as the verse said, the last line, emptiness is protection unsurpassed. If we can really see that, that is the best protection against mental afflictions and suffering, this lack of grasping. So even though it was presented here in a quite elaborate way, again, the simple idea behind this is to do this illusory-like emptiness practice, to really, through understanding and experiencing emptiness in daily life, is to really see that things are not existing as they appear, they are mere appearances, so that we can release the grasping onto them and thereby release any reactions, release any attachment aversion, and thereby release any suffering that would produce. So that's basically what this is sort of pointing to. So again, it's very similar to what we looked at before, this illusory-like emptiness practice. But again, if we want to begin to do this, I would suggest we need those two things. We need to work on the shamatha practice, improve our mindfulness, and then if we can really start to have a little taste of emptiness and meditation, then we can really start to do this practice. And I think then you'll really find enormous benefit in our life. And it really will be protection unsurpassed if we can really start to do this. You'll find that your mental afflictions will dramatically decrease, suffering will dramatically decrease. Okay. Let's break there for afternoon tea. There's a little bit more to say, but I'm more or less finished, and then we're going into sort of the summary of this whole section then. Okay, so let's take a break, come back at 3:30.